You're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show, heading into the last hour now. As you would know, the Dáil narrowly voted in favour of adopting new EU border and immigration policies. Opposition parties had taken issue with some aspects of the pact, but agreed with other measures, such as the sharing of data among EU states. Those voting against it include Deputy Paddy Tobin, leader of AIMTU. Good morning to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to chat.
So, how do you frame this then? You know, a lot of people believe that this is the, you know, one of the single biggest changes really to our sovereignty. Do you think that's going a bit too far? Is that how you would read it?
I think it's a significant shift of sovereignty to the European Union. And, you know, we understand the European Union in general is a positive. We support, obviously, the trade and the economics, the cooperation around those issues. But for AIMTU, we do believe in self-determination. So we believe that decisions made closer to the people that they represent are better decisions, because you can influence those decisions and you can hold the decision makers to account. But when you offload or outsource the significant decision making to Brussels, in many situations, you can't actually influence them. And on some occasions, the European Union has made decisions to Ireland's detriment. So, for example, the whole bank bailout situation, you know, we know that Jean-Claude Trichet rang Michael Noonan and literally threatened him that if he didn't accept the European bailout system, that an economic bomb would go off in Dublin. And that was his words. So, you know, in that situation, we had to take 40% of the cost of the European bailout onto the Irish taxpayer, even though the Irish taxpayer is only 1%. And that worked out about 9,000 euros per person, per man, woman and child. And it significantly affected the 10 years after that in terms of investment. So when you transfer sovereignty to another organization such as Brussels, it can have a detrimental effect. Now, the problem we have with the EU migration pact is this: nobody knows the future. We don't know how much pressure is going to come on the European Union or Ireland in terms of the number of people who want to come to this country.
Well, just in relation to that, do you think, because as I say, you know, in the lead up to this, we were trying to get voices that would actually, you know, not, because we do an awful lot of this in this country as to what floodgates it might open, right? But, you know, obviously sometimes that can be very fearful on one side, or very, you know, it's actually brilliant because it protects us from this and the other side. And often the truth lies somewhere in between. Very hard to get a clear message in relation to this. But I said a little earlier on, and I think people, it didn't land how I intended it to land. Between 2020 and 2024, I believe Ireland took around about 1.3% of asylum applications across the whole EU. One must presume, if we're joining this type of a pact, that the other member states that are taking much more than us are going to say, well, Ireland needs to be doing more lifting here.
Yeah, so like, first of all, we know that there has been a radical increase in the number of movements of people into the European Union just in the last 2 or 3 years. And we also know that there's a significant movement of those people to countries for sure, like Italy and Greece and even Spain, who are on the front line in many ways in relation to this. And you do have to have a system of some sort where there's burden sharing. But like, if we get back to the heart of one of the reasons that movement of people has happened, is because most European countries have been at sixes and sevens in terms of managing this properly. Our own government have basically set up a system whereby a person come into the country, often without any documentation whatsoever, and spend up to 10 years applying for application, you know, having the decision made or appealing the decision all the way to the courts. So what's that message sends out, that actually Ireland is a soft touch in terms of people coming to this country. Now, what we want in AIMTU is a system that actually does help people who are really fleeing from war and violence. You know, if a bomb is landing on a person's home in a country, we should have the moral responsibility to try and help in those situations. But where the system is broken down is that it hasn't differentiated properly between those who need them and those who don't need them.
But to some extent there, Paddy, you sound like you're actually arguing for the EU migration pact.
See, there are step forwards in the EU migration pact. I'll be honest and say that to people. The EU migration pact, in many ways, is a stricter system than the status quo. than exists. But our point is that most of those stricter elements could actually be introduced by the nation states and still sovereignty be maintained. Because the danger is, and this is, I asked the Taoiseach on the floor of the Dáil, how much is this going to cost? And the Taoiseach said he doesn't know. So the Taoiseach has committed to us, committed Ireland to this project, both politically and now through law, to a project where he has no idea how much it's going to cost in the future. Now, obviously, if we control the powers in terms of who comes to the country, but then we can ameliorate potential costs to Ireland in the future. But now that we've outsourced it, we can't control
but
it.
But does this not, if we are part of Europe, does this not get, offer better protections to Europe as a whole? I think it's very clear in political circles that uncontrolled migration, immigration, is not a vote winner. It's bad. We are certainly in a cycle where we're seeing things toughen up in that regard, okay? So if that is going to happen pan-Europe, pan-EU, is it not better then that we have access to the shared resources of that? Because it seems like, as I say, uncontrolled, we saw that in the EU elections, uncontrolled immigration is a big no-no, and it's clear. You've seen the change in language yourself. You would have been seen as a hardliner a year ago, 18 months ago, and now, to some extent, you seem quite liberal in your points of view, such as the political landscape changed.
Yeah, look, and this is the amazing thing, Ian, and one of the problems this points to is, in the political system, there's an awful lot of the political system who just go with whatever way the wind blows. So AIM2 clearly said in 2019 that we must have a sustainable and managed migration policy. We got hammered from on high for even saying those things. And even as short as a year and a half ago, you know, the establishment parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, were hammering AIM2 because we were saying that we need to have common sense in terms of what is happening. But now all of those political parties are stealing our clothes from our wardrobe at the moment. You know, but that's the influence a small party can have on the debate. And that's what we're proud of, being able to have that debate. But going to your question, see, there's no doubt that we need a stricter policy throughout Europe. But we need to maintain sovereignty over those decisions, because I have no doubt in the future decisions will be made which will be against Ireland's interests. And, you know, Ireland is already a net contributor to the basis of billions of euros a year to the European Union. There's no situation that's going to happen in the future where actually Ireland is going to be quids in terms of this solidarity pool. This solidarity pool will be a draw on both our resources and in terms of numbers. And remember, this solidarity pool that's at the heart of the EU migration pact is on top of the numbers who are already coming to Ireland. So this is not just, you know, that we are going to, you know, recalibrate all the people who are coming to Ireland. The people who are coming to Ireland will come to Ireland, but the solidarity pool will add to that. And the danger too, and this is a really important issue, is in future, the EU will be able to change the rules of the EU migration pact on the basis of a qualified majority vote. And that means we won't have a veto, we won't have an opt-out at that stage, and we'll just have to do what we're told. And like, we have this opt-out along with Denmark, and we could exercise it, and we could actually align a lot of the Eurodac and security.
We can cherry-pick the six key elements of this. But listen, people aren't happy with how this vote was pushed through here. I want to talk to you a little bit about that in a moment. But we'll go to that right now. Like, people feel that this has been pushed through, that that there wasn't enough time given to it. We saw this with the defective concrete block as well. That there seemed to be like, well, let's get it through in 5 hours. Then it was deferred, and people saying, well, why is it deferred? And then it was passed late last night. Like, and it was passed by a very slim majority, 79-73. A lot of people, all of that element of how this has come about and given the significance of it is not resting easy with people, with how, you know, sort of politics is working in this country.
Yeah, so basically, really, this only appeared into general debate probably around February, March, April of this year. So this was tipping away for sure in the European Union for the last couple of years, but really hasn't come into general debate until that period of time. And interestingly, it was practically disappeared as an issue until after the local and European elections. And that was done strategically by Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, because they didn't want it to be part of the debate for the European elections. So they left it till just afterwards, so it wouldn't become a defining factor of how people are going to vote. And then again, you know, in the Dáil, we have this system where, you know, it happens in a very fast period. Something like this should actually be teased out properly, sometimes in by way of referendums, so that actually you have a citizen's engagement with an issue such as this. But of course, the governments don't do those types of politics. They use politics to ram through their objectives. And, you know, people often say, well, you know, this was undemocratic in the way it's done. People have to realize that the government will use every tool they have within the law, of course, and they have to say that, to achieve their objectives.
Well, this is probably a good time for me to say that we've, and listen, we have, generally speaking, we don't have any problem with accessing people on this program, thankfully, at all different levels of politics. We're very lucky in that regard. We've reached out to 5, 6, 7, I think it was 8 in the end, of people who endorsed this or voted for this, and none of them were available. So in case this conversation seems a little bit skewed, trust me, the voices that we normally get on lots of different things weren't available to us today. I just want to put one final point to you. The public might say, people might feel that we couldn't implement the current system. You know, we heard the figures. A lot of them were, in fairness to Aintu and yourself, a lot of them were attained by you in terms of, you know, deportations and all this kind of stuff and the implementation and the slowness of the system. Like, why, if we sign up to a new system, should or could people have any faith on the implementation of that? Let's not forget there are other EU rules that we're currently paying millions upon millions a year because we can't implement them correctly, okay? So it's not like we have a full card on this. So if we can't implement what we had, even though it wasn't right, some would say, well, we still have to be responsible for implementing this. Where are these detention centres going to go?
I think this your point is one of the most important points of this whole debate. So, for example, Ireland is already signed up to the Dublin 3 Convention. This is where we can return people to countries in which they were registered first. But in that process, out of 180 people who were agreed to be transferred back to their own countries, Ireland only transferred 3 of them. Ireland is signed up to a myriad of different commitments to the European Union and is failing on a rake of them and is paying fines on the basis of tens of millions of euros a year in non-fulfilling those commitments. You know, the European EU fined Ireland 2.5 million last year for our wastewater issues, 1.5 million for the environmental impact assessment issues, 17 million euros because of the Derry Brine wind farm, 2 million euros because of the money laundering directive. And we're going to come to 2030 and we're not going to meet our CO2 reduction targets. And Ireland will be fined hundreds of millions of euros. So this government pretends this is some kind of magic wand to deal with the issues. But it's not, because in the end of the day, we still have to have a processing time. And that processing time can only be determined by funding people who will process. And, you know, at the back of this European Migration Pact is, if we don't fulfil the requirements, there will be legal process against us, and we will get fined. We're setting ourselves up for a fall here.
I didn't see the debate here, to be honest with you. I didn't get an opportunity to access it. But another elephant in the room for me is, by the government's own figures, the majority of people coming into Ireland illegally at the moment, well, they're not illegal once they land in here, but coming into Ireland at the moment, coming from Britain / Northern Ireland, a.k.a. the UK, Rishi Sunak has already said, because it would prove his Rwanda plan is working, he ain't taking these people back. So the EU border and immigration pact that's so controversial and that we've signed up to has no provision actually to deal with the main source of immigration into this country, because 90-odd percent are coming in from UK. They're not part of this pact. They're not taking these people back. So really, all this is really to deal with, what, the 10 or 15% and then whatever comes in on top of that. Again, as I hope that was raised in the doll. I didn't get to see much of the debate at all, but it doesn't make any sense to a lot of people.
No, you're right. And it was only because of Aintu's questions that the minister actually copped on that about 80% of people were coming from the north of Ireland into the south in terms of applications. But you're completely right in terms of, if we want to solve 80 to 90% of this issue, we need to solve that issue with the London government. And in truth, the London government will only solve this with us if it has a solution with the French government, because it wants to be able, it won't accept returns from the southern state unless France will accept returns from Britain. So leaving Britain out of any discussions or negotiations in this is a mistake. And that's why we aim to have called for Ireland, Britain and France to sit down and have a discussion to actually resolve that. That would actually fix it. I actually think that this EU migration pact is not going to work because countries like Hungary and Poland are just not going to accept it, to be honest. And what you're going to find is that it's a sticking plaster for a political problem that the European Union wants to put in place so that it can do better in the elections.
Another concern, though, is when the big nations on mainland Europe don't want to play ball, and I'm thinking farming and fishing, where does Brussels generally go to find a solution, or who are the whipping boys, or who will curtsy? And it's often Ireland. I'm not fear-mongering because I don't really know where this is going to go. And to be honest with you, as far as I am aware, it could be good for Ireland. I don't know. All I know is that Ireland currently is a backdoor into Europe, European citizenship. We have no way of no agreement with the British to deal with people escaping the Rwanda plan. These are people that have been living in Britain. Not they haven't just landed yesterday. They've been there for 5-10 years. They don't want to go to Rwanda. They want EU citizenship. They come here, get naturalised or whatever the process is, and then they're free to move wherever they want to. So this, we are actually creating a funnel, I believe, into Ireland. I don't mean that fearful because I don't think a lot of these people even want to stay here. Do you know what I mean? So I'm not scared of a depopulation or replacement as much as some might be. But Ireland needs to be prepared.
Yeah, I think at the heart of Ireland's EU policy for the last 20 or 30 years has the instinct to be the best boy in the class. And in other words, to be very meek and gentle in terms of its negotiations with the EU for our national interests. And that has been our biggest problem. And that's one of the reasons why 15% of all the fish that's actually fished in Irish waters are fished by Irish fishermen and fisherwomen, and the rest is actually fished by European fishermen. So we need to become far more robust in terms of our engagements with the European Union. Other countries have no problem with being robust, fighting for their national interest. And that's how the system works. But, you know, unfortunately, that's not the instinct of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens at all. And secondly, we do need a situation whereby Ireland holds the powers that we have in Leinster House. Because if Brussels does something that we don't like, we can do nothing about it. We can't get rid of Brussels, or we can't get rid of the regime in Brussels. But if the government here does something that we don't like, we can fire them at the next election. And that's the beauty of democracy. That's the beauty of self-determination. And that's the beauty of sovereignty. And this decision by Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens to hand over that sovereignty to the European Union is a major mistake. And it's one that's going to come back to bite this country in the future.
We shall see. My apologies if that sounded more like a discussion than an interview, but I have to represent the views of the people contacting the show as well. And despite our best efforts, we couldn't get anyone who voted or supported the pact to come on and discuss that this morning. As I say, it's not that we have issues generally getting people on. It just seems to be this issue or other on holidays or whatever it might be. Paddy Tobin, thanks very much indeed. How unusual, by the way, before I let you go, how unusual is it that you get on the phone to... You get on the phone to a senior official from a council at a count.
A senior official?
Yeah, you're the returning officer. You had a convo with them on the telephone. Obviously.
Yeah, no, this is the returning officer in...
Is that unusual in Letterkenny? Obviously, just for those who not be aware, Mary T. Sweeney, it was during the election time. There was question marks as to who would get eliminated and there was not many votes and what have you. You must have got a call... and thought it worth to pursue that. We're not going to rehearse that. It was perfectly good, and I think everyone was very pleased to see democracy in action. It's not controversial. Just wondering how unusual it might be.
Yeah, and I would say fair play to Mary T, because one of her statements after that was to say that democracy had been done, and she accepted the results and the will of the people in relation to that. And she's a wonderful candidate, and I want to thank her and her team. It's not massively unusual, believe it or not. Most returning officers operate on the basis of common sense and cooperation. So, for example, there was a recount in another part of the country, and I spoke to a returning officer on the phone there. There was another recount in a third place in the country, and actually that was a very robust situation where the returning officer didn't really engage at all with the teams. And the problem is in those situations is that when cooperation leaves the room, the instincts of political parties is to tool up in terms of senior counsel and barristers then. And that actually, you know, draws out the whole process in a far slower manner. So most political parties will operate in common sense situations in terms of counts. And some will go over the top a little bit in terms of robustness, but a good returning officer will manage that in a common sense, logical way.
Yeah, that's what happens in Donegal. Yeah, for sure. All right, great stuff. Thanks for that. Just curious. Thank you very much indeed. Pádraig Tobin there, Deputy Pádraig Tobin, sorry, I should say, who is leader of Aintdhu. Okay, we have a very big band of loyal stream watchers. Always nice to see you say hello, pop up and say hello. There are hundreds of you watching across our platforms and on our website. So if you want to say hello, please do. We have regulars who check in, about 36 of them regulars that check in every day, and it's great to see they're there. And then when they don't check in, I wonder where Beth is. Beth is normally watching at this stage. Where is she? So if you want to check in on our social media, if you're watching the show, please do. It's lovely to see you there. Right, Andreas is in Sweden and joins us on the program now. Good morning, Andreas.
Hi, good morning, Greg.
Good to chat to you. Right, okay. Your view on representative democracy, and a note in your email, representative is in quotes. Talk to me.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's very representative anymore. I get the idea was brilliant when communication and transportation was an issue, and so they were bottlenecks, and so people were sending representatives to parliament or government. But now when we have the tools to vote across the whole of Europe in a song contest, well, I think people could asked more directly and maybe don't need representatives, because this whole representative is very expensive. Essentially, they are not really accountable anyway. Once they are there, they can sit out their time. It's very slow and inefficient, especially because of that. And then most of the parties that won't vote for, they offer a package deal. So they're not really representative in that sense as well. By package deal, I mean that I might agree on the politics regarding schools or immigration or climate or whatever with one party, but not on other issues. And then I agree with the views of other parties on the other issues, but I need to pick one, and then that's representing me in all of the issues, when in reality I only really agree with them on one.
So the connection between you and decisions that are made, really, it's a maze that it would be very hard to trace back your democratic vote really to the processes in Europe. But I haven't really heard this point articulated as well as you have, Andreas, but it's a very interesting point. You know, how democratic is representative democracy? Because you talk about packages and what have you. Ireland's representatives are being asked really to vote in favour of Ursula von der Leyen, because that means that the former finance minister might get a plum job in Europe. It's back-scratching, a lot of it, it seems.
Yes, exactly. And then let's say even that they would represent you. Part of the politics is actually to make compromises, if you like, back-scratching, but not necessarily, because you might get some tangible benefits for your actual voters. But it could be that they're making compromises on an issue that really was key for you when you voted for them, in order to get policy through in another issue that wasn't really important for you. Mm-hmm. And then they can say that, well, we're still representing what our voters voted for, because we are, you know, okay in 9 out of 10 points that we promised in our campaign. But the one point that I was very interested in, and that's what set them apart and I voted for them, is the one where they are making a compromise. So the other 9, they might represent still, but they are not representing me anymore in that sense. So it's a bit a tricky situation. And also with representatives, I think the possibility of what you put back-scratching, but also lobbying from big industrial interests is much higher than if people are votes. So like you can pay off one representative easily with any kind of benefit, but it's difficult to do that with the entire county of Donegal. Or if they do, then the entire county of Donegal benefits from it, right? Because everyone gets something.
Mm-hmm. Andreas, I mean, listen, if you went to the public with every decision, obviously, you know, it would be very difficult.
No, you can't. Important decisions.
Yeah. So in other words, maybe in attitudes towards conflict, finance, immigration, do you think there should be a key sort of a key set of things that the public pan-Europe, pan-EU are consulted on, rather than this representative democracy you describe Is that how you would see a better system? Is that your better system?
Yeah, I think so. I'm a scientist. I'm a researcher. And the way it works in science is that if you have a new idea or a proposal, it goes through an expert panel. So you need to show a cost-benefit potential evaluation for your project. And this could be the same. It needs to go through an expert panel. If you want to reform healthcare or if you want to have anything on migration, it needs to go through experts that would analyze it carefully and then propose different routes to the public where the public could vote for it. And then they would see, you know, the potential benefits and the potential cost of all of this, as opposed to ideas lifted by politicians.
Yeah,
and of course it needs to be to key issues.
Yeah, but also, yeah. Andreas, I mean, you said you're a scientist, or a scientist you said you are, yeah?
I'm a chemist.
Chemist, okay, right. So it's a broad field, a broad field, right? And you probably are quite knowledgeable in a broad area, but you have specific expertise that you you formulate what you formulate, and then you kick it up the chain and what have you. Politics is kind of strange in that, you know, we've got, say, for instance, our new finance minister here is a background in law, yet he's now going to be in charge of a multi-billion euro budget, or is he? That is the question. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it, that in areas of things like science and chemistry or what have you, we make sure, I'm not going to put you in working on a project that you don't know much about, because that'd be a waste of your skill set, Andreas. But it doesn't seem to apply to politics, really. It's about who you know, who your dad was, who your mom was. If you're being,
absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's a crazy old system. We all are asked to be a part of.
I totally agree, and it's funny how people buy this, because it's always been so. But in reality, you wouldn't take your car for repair to your local grocer. I mean, you would take it to a car mechanic, but you wouldn't ask your neighbour who's seen all the episodes of ER to do a surgery on your kid. You would take it to a doctor. Yeah. But you trust these politicians to make decisions about everything that they have absolutely no background in. Yeah. Exactly right.
All right, okay. Yeah. Andreas, I think I've spoke to you before and I think I've asked you before. Do you have connections to the northwest of Ireland?
I just love that place. Whenever I have a chance, I go and visit Donegal. I really love Donegal.
All right, listen, great.
And I listen to your show all the time.
I love that. I love it. In Sweden. You're based in Sweden.
I'm in the very north, close to the Arctic Circle, yes.
Okay, right. So when we all get excited about the Northern Lights, you're like, what?
Yeah, exactly. That's like common occurrence. No, not really. But yeah, that's truly exciting, though. But it's much more visible here than
of course,
in Donegal.
Yeah.
Even when you say really nice ones, they are much stronger here.
All right, Andreas, take care of yourself. Thanks so much. That's Andreas in Sweden. And I always find it fascinating to hear from or speak to people who listen to the programme that, you know, might visit here but aren't necessarily from here. And there are regular listeners. And if you're one of them, just let us know. We don't have to talk to you. Just let us know where you listen from on a daily or other day basis. 00353 866 6025000. I always find that fascinating. Or if you're listening to the podcast or the overnight, email us comments@highlandradio.com, or indeed throw a comment. Look, there's Beth. Beth, I picked that name out of the sky because I see your name, Beth, so often. Beth's watching us on YouTube. Hiya, Beth. Beth McDade. Lovely to have you on board. Right, let me see. I think I have to take a quick break. We have loads of comments coming. It's been a really one of those shows whereby a lot of you feel motivated to take the phone out and text us in. It's all, we know you're there, but it's always nice to when it's really busy on the text, because we get a real sense of that. And this show is so important, of course, and only the show's not important. Sorry. What makes the show important is listeners, because without them, I'm just sitting here waffling in an empty room. Some say I do that anyway. So we were chatting earlier to Dennis. He was coming in to flag a public information meeting on defective concrete in Dunloe next Tuesday night, but also referenced his recent trip to Galway. He had to go down for a scan to check his system, and had to leave at 4, got there at 9, 4-9, got there a little bit late, but the consultant there was saying, look, you know, an awful lot of people have to travel down here. And then we were worried, I do worry about those that get those letters and don't take on that trip or that journey because they don't want to, they can't, they don't have a vehicle, they can't get access to a bus, whatever it might be. Paul's joining us as well, who's got an experience of heading to Galway. Paul, how are you getting on?
No, not so bad at all, Greg.
Good stuff. All right, the story starts with an infection in your foot, and take it from there, Paul.
Yeah, well, Greg, I'm the type 2 diabetic. You see, I got an infection in my foot. And actually, when I first got it, it started to clear up again with antibiotics. And it was, I thought it was fine, but then it came back on me. And it was a bank holiday weekend at the end of October. And on the bank holiday Monday, I had to go to the hospital with Letterkenny because my toe had turned black.
Okay.
So I spent the night up in Letterkenny in A&E, and then the following morning I was taking my ambulance to Galway. Mm. And I spent the day in Galway and got the toe amputated. So, but what I was stating is, to me it was something simple, and it was up and down to Galway, and my wife, I'm a man in my 60s, and my wife had to make the same journey 2 or 3 times up and down as well, just to visit me, like.
And how long were you in with the after the toe was amputated, Paul?
8 days.
Right, okay.
No, it was 8 days, but even after the 8 days, they were saying I might have to stay another week, but thank God I didn't have to, anyway, so.
And of course, they were making sure that everyone, was going according to plan. But you're saying, like, why was I taken to Letterkenny for such a, what would probably be seen as a simple procedure?
Correct, yeah. That's what I didn't understand. I was in the vascular ward down in Galway as well. That's why I rang in, because it's the same ward. But the care I got in Galway, I couldn't fault it. Excellent. Mm. And the care, post-op care I've had since was excellent. I can't fault any of the care I got.
Okay.
It's just the travelling up and down to Galway for what to me was a minor procedure.
Yeah, doesn't make sense, does it?
No. As you say, it's 4.5 hours up, 4.5 hours down. And
you only had to do it once? Your poor wife had to do it a few times?
She had to do it 3 times, yeah.
Yeah.
That was it. And I say, it's not like you can just go down and book in somewhere, because I don't know if you know what Galway is. Very hard to get anywhere.
All right, Paul. You know, it's an interesting point, well made. How are you feeling now? Are you okay?
Oh, I'm perfectly well. It's like it never happened now, Greg, to be honest with you. Like, so,
all right, good stuff.
That's just
Listen, weird. Thanks for helping us highlight the situation again, Paul. Take care of yourself, and best wishes to you and your wife.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Cheers, Greg.
Take care. Bye-bye. We're joined on the programme now by Karina Malloy, author of A Woman in Defence. Karina, good morning to you.
Good morning, hi.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, no problem. I nearly didn't get there after waiting all morning.
Oh, my apologies.
I pressed the wrong button.
Okay. A judge-led tribunal examining the complaints process around sexual abuse and discrimination in the Defence Forces has begun with an appeal for potential witnesses to come forward. I suppose this has been labelled the Women of Honour Tribunal. From your perspective, you initially flagged your concerns in 2019, calling for action and accountability and indeed an apology. So what does this mean to you and your fight for justice, I suppose?
Yeah, well, first of all, I just want to acknowledge that, just want to say that I'm no longer a member of the Women of Honour group. And so whatever I say now is my own opinion. And I just want to acknowledge the courage and the bravery of the woman, the one woman that did actually start the Women of Honour group. And unfortunately, I can't even name her because she still wants to stay anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to admire her bravery and her courage. And I'm wondering how she's feeling today or on Monday. That would be a bittersweet sort of accolade that the tribunal has started now. But it all stemmed from her and her ability to get Katie Hannon to come on board for our original documentary. Because of the brave women that were in that documentary, a few of the women that are now in the current Women of Honour group didn't actually flatly refuse to come into the documentary, but yet they are now front and centre of the group. But aside from that, yes, the 4 A's that we looked for initially, the acknowledgement, the apology, the action and the accountability, it is wonderful that we've got 2 out of 4 of those A's, the acknowledgement and the action. So we've got the tribunal now, and now we hope that we will get the accountability. Now, Simon Coveney, when he was the Minister of Defence at the time, when I was still in the Woman of Honour, he said that he would give us a public apology when the IRG report came out, but that we're still waiting for that public apology. He, of course, is now no longer the Minister of Defence, but we're still waiting for our public apology because the IRG report was nothing damning from the Defence Forces' point of view and how they treated women. So, you know, it'd be up to the minister now, but he probably will wait until the end of the 3-year tribunal. So, but anyway, we've got there.
But you've waited decades for this. So, I mean, 3 years does seem like a long time, but you've waited decades. And if the right outcome is arrived at and there is the right level of accountability and that apology, it's worth the wait potentially for the extra 3 years.
Yeah, well, it'll be over 40 years for me. Because it was 40 years ago, I had my first microaggression when I joined the army because of my gender. So yeah, an extra 3 years won't make any difference. I'll be at that stage an old age pensioner, so I don't mind. I'll be sitting back waiting for it.
Okay. Can you recount your? I know you have before, and I'm sorry to sort of drag you over old coals again, Karina. But you know your experience of being in the army and, you know, making statements, the reaction to those statements, you being seen, you know, and the way you were seen in your own words, if that's okay, Karina.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not pushing my book, but I mean, there's a lot of, I buried my soul in the book.
Yeah, no, and listen, push it. And the book, A Woman in Defence, by the way, it's still there, still available. Don't be shy to give it a plug. My God, you lived your experience.
Okay, and you are.
There you go. That's what I like to see. All right, Karina.
So, But the one thing that really hurt me was after all my publicity and everything else, it was the veterans attacking me. For doing and stepping up and stepping out of line. And they accused me of unspeakable things on Facebook. And that's the real hurtful thing from all of this.
But do they not know, Karina, that you were, that it's actually probably, I can't put words in your mouth, but it's because you care, presumably, yes, that you want to highlight. And also, too, for those that follow you, there's almost a duty of care to them to ensure that things don't change. Sweeping things under the carpet never got us anywhere in this country.
No. Well, this country doesn't do accountability and it sweeps everything under the carpet. But my whole aim for the book and for originally joining the Woman of Honour was, of course, to help every other young girl in the likes of, now we're I was speaking in Donegal, the likes of the young female private isolated up in Finner Camp. And it's going through horrendous time to allow her to say, well, look, Karina Molloy and so on. So they all went through it. And there is an avenue there. There is an avenue now open for me to get help. And that's why I exposed myself to, and that's why I stayed for 31 years to try and make a difference. Mm. As I've always said, if you want to change the room, you have to stay in the room. Mm-hmm. Because you, by leaving the army because they constructively dismiss you, you're not helping yourself and you're not helping others. You have to put the head down and stay and try and make a difference. And that's what I tried to do.
And just one other reaction, one other question to the reaction from veterans to your book. Obviously, you suffered horrible abuse and commentary. Did that outweigh the good? Because I presume and I would hope there were some that said, look, this story needed to be told, fair play to you. You've got the best motivation to do this. Or was it mostly negative towards you, Karina, I wonder, from the veterans?
Yeah, no, thankfully there was only a chosen few, okay, of those nasty remarks. And thank God a lot of veterans came to my rescue. And they were actually told to get a grip and
wind your neck and
and to take them down, and they were actually eventually taken down.
Will you speak?
It did hurt at the time, of course, but anyway.
No, of course, and those that can take a time to heal. Will you be giving evidence at the tribunal? Is it something you're looking forward to?
I'm not looking forward to it, but because it's dredging up and opening old wounds again. Mm. But yes, absolutely, I will of course be given evidence to the tribunal, and I'd like to urge other people at this stage to come forward. And I think maybe perhaps people are under the illusion or under the impression that you have to belong to one of the stakeholders groups. You have to approach the Women of Honour, or you have to approach the Defence Forces Alliance or the Irish Men and Women of Honour. But you don't. You can go in as an individual, ring the tribunal helpline, get help from them, get your legal representation, which I have yet to do, and write your statement and go in and hold your head high and do your oral statement. And I just want to emphasise also, if you're afraid to say it in public, the tribunal is giving the option to do it in private.
Miss Justice Power said, it's not about winning or losing, but establishing the truth. Is that how you see it too?
Oh yes, absolutely. As the good Buddha said, there's three things you can't hide. Can't hide the sun or the moon or the truth. The truth will eventually come out.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Can you hold your book up for me again one more time, please?
Sure.
It is A Woman in Defence, The Story of the Enemy Within the Irish Army. Karina Malloy wrote that book. And I think it's very insightful. If you hear about the Women of Honour or what used to go on, and as Karina mentioned, she's no longer a member of that organisation. But if you actually want to know the lived experience of what went on, and certainly with a local perspective, I would strongly recommend that book. And I really appreciate your time, Karina. Thank you so very much. And sorry if I kept you waiting. My apologies. Have a wonderful day.
That's okay, Greg. Thank you very much for
having me.
Take care.
Thanks so much for all of you texting in on the programme. We voted no, says this listener, for the Lisbon Treaty twice. They've pushed it through against the will of the people. We need a referendum on migration and neutrality. Greg, they can throw out all the old statistics they like. 1.1 sounds like nothing. People walking down the street in Letterkenny or any other large or small town in Ireland can see with their own eyes the number of non-Irish people in this country. And it certainly feels like a hell of a lot more than 1.1%. Load of rubbish, these stats. And I think government will find that out in the general election. Generally, the majority are in more populated areas. I did notice in Galway recently, in Dublin recently, the demographic has changed significantly already. Why was this not put to the people? Because they know the same as the last referendum, they'd get hammered. Another. In all honesty, why does Ireland have to take a share of the burden? Most of the asylum seekers are from non-war-torn countries. The whole idea, by the way, is that this new system will weed out economic migrants and what have you. But anyway, a lot of people wouldn't have faith in that. Why should we accept anyone who comes here illegally without paperwork? We are kowtowing to NGOs who know the facts. Look at all the crossings, the border from the UK, never mind Europe. Ireland's TD sold out its people. Maybe it's not a united Ireland on the cards, but Irexit is possible the only way now. Well, the British tried it and they're seeing record numbers, despite what the Prime Minister is saying. They're seeing record numbers of people arriving into their country. So leaving Europe didn't fix that. Could Charlie McConnellogue and Joe McHugh explain why they voted yes? Well, Charlie McConnellogue has a long-established stance now that he won't speak to this programme while I am presenting it. Joe McHugh's at an event, I'm told, and was trying to squeeze us in between 12 but couldn't. I think that the conversation regarding the EU migration is like trying to bolt a gate after the horse has gone. This should have been brought up before the elections. The public wanted a debate, but nobody would entertain it. Another, I think the government should not have opted into this. The people need to vote. It should have been the question in the referendum and let the people decide. This was rammed through and has put Ireland in an awful position. I just cried last night seeing this, says a listener. I've read that one. Please... I think that the conversation regarding the EU migration is like, wow, I've got doubled up here. I really think that Ireland should get out of the EU. It's not good for Ireland with all the regulations they're putting on us. They don't realise that farming is very important to us here in Ireland. They're blaming us for carbon. I wonder, too, the farmers going to get under more pressure now because, see, the transport carbon reductions, that ain't happening. People aren't buying electric cars anymore for a number of reasons. The charging infrastructure is woeful, some would say. Also, the second-hand resale value of electric cars has dropped because the new purchase price of cars has dropped. So people aren't buying electric cars in the same numbers anymore. And we're supposed to have, a million electric cars, carbon neutral at the exhaust by 2030. That's not happening. So who's going to pick up the slack? I would say the farmers will probably be high on the list there, unfortunately. Ursula von der Leyen should not be supported by Ireland. We should be supporting innocent children being killed in Gaza. It's absolutely disgusting. But what bothers me most about that is the reason, and it's front and centre, it's been said by Leo Varadkar, the former Prime Minister himself, the former Taoiseach himself. He said that we have a better chance of getting Michael McGrath a better job if we vote for her. Funny old way of working, but that's the way it is. Please say a big hello to Isha Reid, who is the best sister to her brother. Love from Mammy. Isha attends the Autism Support House in Elms. Lots of lovely words about Elms as well. Well done, girls. Brilliant service. And it's an honour to work with children and carers. And also, too, we got a donation, by the way, to pay for a bus. You didn't give me that info, did you? He doesn't want named, but it's a good donation. So we had a caller who listens to the show, by the way, after that appeal, and is paying for a bus trip, which will lighten the load somewhat, which is fantastic, isn't it? I love this show, and I love the people that listen to it, and I love this county and everything we stand for. Right, back tomorrow at 9 with the usual Friday panel and other stuff as well. John's next. Have a good Thursday.